Hi there, and welcome to a pubcast. Pubcasts are annotated and abridged audiobook-style recordings of peer-reviewed scientific research read to you by the authors. Today, that author is me, Dr. Hannah Harrison at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia, Canada. Today, I will be reading to you a paper entitled A Commentary on the Role of Hatcheries and Stocking Programs in Salmon Conservation and Adapting Ourselves to Less Than Wild Futures. This paper was published by Fish and Fisheries in late May of 2024. It is written by myself, Hannah Harrison, and Dr. Valerie Burseth, who at the time of writing was affiliated with the Department of Geography and Environmental Studies at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. Please note that pubcasts are designed to be very listenable. That means that they don't have all of the in-text citations or other things that we would look for in traditional scholarship. If you would like to see all of those things, and we definitely encourage you to do so, you can find the online version of this paper linked in the show notes of the episode that you are currently listening to. Thanks again for listening to a pubcast, and I hope you enjoy. In the Anthropocene, questions of how to manage wildlife and its ecosystems are ever challenging. Wildness or naturalness have emerged as benchmarks in some species as a delineation of whether humans may enact conservation and through what means. In both Pacific and Atlantic salmon, the discussion of wildness and conservation approaches is exemplified within the debate over hatcheries and stocking as conservation tools, particularly in how wildness and naturalness are intertwined with understandings of fitness and values of maintaining biodiversity and adaptive capacity in salmon populations. And whether hatchery and stocking efforts are effective, successful, or good in achieving conservation goals. In recent decades, divergent perspectives over the use of hatcheries to stem losses or to rebuild salmon populations have become contentious and polarized, particularly in contexts where non-hatchery-produced populations still exist. This debate is increasingly driven by a focus on the genetic and, more recently, epigenetic impacts of hatchery-origin salmon on non-hatchery-origin salmon populations. Within the broader literature, studies have demonstrated that hatchery production can produce a wide variety of problems. These can include heritable maladaptive genes and reduced fitness within just one generation, and similarly, deleterious consequences for salmon population dynamics and demographics. Those might include changes in population structure, reduced effective population sizes, altered migration and spawn timing, early maturation, replacement of wild salmon with hatchery origin fish, reduced resistance to infection, reduced evolutionary fitness, and other issues. As a result, the risks of hatchery production extend to the broader populations of salmonids with whom hatchery fish interbreed, challenging the effectiveness of hatcheries as a conservation tool. And yet, hatcheries continue to be used as conservation tools, particularly in places where salmon runs are in decline. So why does stocking persist, despite all of the controversy that's very well documented in the literature? Well, we have heard multiple explanations from our colleagues in the scientific community, ranging from the perception that local communities or managers are ignorant or naive of the negative or fruitless outcomes of stocking for conservation, to what one might consider as the more condemning language of the seven H's, which are from a 2017 NASSCO report. And they point toward misplaced things like hope, hubris, habits, and other human frailties that are elicited or perhaps enacted by hatcheries in the pursuit of conservation outcomes. And while these explanations may be true, or at least in part true, observations in our own research suggest that they really only explain part of a bigger story that is rooted in concerns for the future and a shifting calculus around the values of wild within those salmon places that really teeter on the edge of climate-driven change and potentially irreversible loss. Now, in this perspective, we adopt a future-oriented lens to interrogate the role that hatcheries may play in salmon conservation at that advancing edge of climate change impacts. While much of the concern about genetic risks is attributed to large-scale hatchery production concerns, rather, here we are focused specifically on hatcheries that produce salmon for conservation purposes. Our aim here is not to refute science demonstrating negative genetic and other impacts of hatchery programs on wild populations. Generally, we really understand and support that point of view. And neither are we here to argue that hatcheries are a panacea for biodiversity loss. Unequivocally, we would say they are not. However, we question the merits of reductionist positions that overly simplify the multifaceted and context-dependent issue of what constitutes an appropriate salmon through definitions of wild. And so in this, we offer two arguments, followed by two warnings. First, we say that the criteria for measuring the success of conservation hatcheries must be expanded beyond genetic reference points and their relationships to fitness and adaptive capacity, or baselines of wild salmon pasts, as salmon social ecological systems are disrupted by climate change. The second thing we'll discuss is the present debate is missing a broader engagement with the social and cultural contexts in which conservation hatcheries operate, and the changes that communities face in conserving salmon relationships, which they will continue to face in a no-analog future. We propose that the knowledge infrastructures that surround salmon conservation-oriented hatchery and stocking programs must adapt to remain sustainable, useful, and relevant to the communities, both human and non-human, in which they are embedded. Finally, we warn that our arguments should not be misinterpreted as permission to stock, but rather that they are an effort to expand the salmon conservation stocking debate forward into new and more productive arenas. Section 2, caught in a lose-lose paradox. Salmon hatcheries come in many shapes and sizes, and they operate based on any number of stated and sometimes unstated objectives, including restoration, mitigation, fisheries enhancement, and conservation. These objectives are, by and large, about the production of fish for various users, or occasionally for the existence of fish themselves or ecosystems approaches to restoration. We limit our focus to conservation-oriented stocking, which aims to restore extinct, endangered, or threatened populations, or to reduce the risk of extinction. While some may argue that large-scale production hatcheries achieve conservation aims by increasing overall population sizes, we specifically refer to stocking programs which generally operate at smaller scales. They rely on local broodstock, and they explicitly aim to minimize the threats of introduction to non-hatchery populations, and are often, but not always, engaged in local communities of practice. Often, conservation hatcheries are used as a last line of defense against extinction, though the decision to introduce conservation-focused stocking activities varies across contexts. So with all that in mind, we argue that the hatchery debate really hinges on a central question. Are hatcheries effective conservation tools? One's answer to this question can be broadly understood to stem from two endpoints on a spectrum of desired outcomes. Whether conservation hatcheries produce a qualitatively good returning adult salmon capable of reproduction and, importantly, human use, which could include existence value. Or, two, whether conservation hatcheries produce a genetically good salmon that reflects wild, or at least non-hatchery origin, historical genetic population and or subpopulation composition, and does not detract from the total effective population, is capable of reproduction, and then those human-oriented priorities. This latter set of desired outcomes aligns with priorities in evolutionary ecology, population biology, genetics, and ecology literature that prioritize wild-type fish and situates conservation hatcheries in essentially a lose-lose paradox when used to support existing wild, which are sometimes called natural, populations. The conservation hatchery paradox can be described as such. On one hand, if conservation hatcheries work, that is, they produce meaningful numbers of returning adult spawners, those hatchery origin fish create a variety of negative effects for existing non-hatchery origin populations. Broadly, these effects can be created in hatchery origin fish by both the contained rearing environment and by the process by which mating pairs are matched. In other words, the fish they create are not sufficiently wild-type enough to interact with non-hatchery origin stocks without consequence. And as a result, a conservation hatchery and stocking program that successfully creates returning adults to spawn with or amongst wild populations is ultimately creating harm through the successful production of less than wild fish. And in the context of climate change, there is particular concern about negative impacts on adaptive capacity. Now, on the other hand, if conservation hatcheries do not work, that is, no meaningful production of returning adult spawners, they are perceived as a waste of money and effort, possibly to the detriment of other salmon conservation activities, such as habitat improvement. Further, any fish that do return may still have deleterious effects on existing non-hatchery origin stocks anyway. This summary of the paradox facing conservation hatcheries is meant to be illustrative, and it does lack a lot of the nuance and detail of many of the biophysical processes that are mentioned. It is further compounded by the challenges of effectively monitoring stocking efficacy. Similarly, we acknowledge that some work refutes or gives exceptions to this cycle, and we strongly emphasize that hatcheries and stocking programs are really contextual, and it makes it different to generalize perfectly across these programs. However, we illustrate this paradox to demonstrate that the issue of wildness within hatcheries, particularly in defining their effectiveness or appropriateness for conservation, is at the core of the hatchery debate. This discussion has found a crucible in the genetics literature, specifically in how it delineates and defines wildness via genetic and epigenetic impacts wrought by the captive rearing process on hatchery-reared fish and, later, by those fish on non-hatchery-reared conspecifics. As our understanding of genetics has improved, definitions of what distinguishes wild and hatchery salmon has shifted from qualitative indicators like behavior or appearance to technically driven definitions. In response, jurisdictions across the salmon stocking world are responding to advances in genetic science by, broadly speaking, reforming hatchery and genetic management plans to minimize the genetic risks by prioritizing and monitoring genetic diversity within stock systems, though I will say budgetary constraints do remain a challenge to this. We are also pursuing the production of more wild-type salmon through approaches such as captive habitat enrichment and hatchery reform. And we are curtailing or eliminating conservation stocking programs altogether. Related to environmental governance trends towards ecological risk aversion and improved knowledge of the effects of the hatchery environment on salmon, some authors describe hatchery-based stocking programs as an exercise in hubris or demonstrations of techno-arrogance and halfway technologies. Others have described conservation stocking programs as appropriate only in scenarios where and when there is no wild salmon, or where and when the integrity of wild salmon is not a management priority. In that same vein, other authors have argued that hatcheries are really only appropriate where populations are exigent or in a state of being critically endangered and where threats cannot be removed. In such cases, live gene banks or the capture, transport, and stocking of wild fry are suggested. To be clear, we share in the concern and critique of many hatchery and stocking programs from ecological, biological, and genetic points of view, including in the context of conservation-based stocking. We also maintain that the social benefits of stocking do not alleviate the ecological problems, nor are they an excuse to stock irresponsibly. However, we do argue that these concerns are one part of a larger picture wherein salmon-dependent communities are facing the potential of a future without salmon, and that additional factors relevant to assessing the efficacy of hatchery programs are often missed by those aforementioned prescriptions. Part 3. Conservation for who, when, and why. Conservation-oriented hatcheries and stocking programs often sit at the intersection of complex social ecological systems. In some places, these systems have become the ragged edge of no analog climate futures and accompanying societal shifts. Hatchery programs conserve more than fish. They also support the continuation of human-salmon relationships. Where conservation work is undertaken by communities, hatcheries can facilitate social and psychological benefits to those who are participating in stocking. And they act as locations where scientific and local knowledge may be used and hybridized together for conservation purposes and provide local employment opportunities. The social outcomes of conservation hatchery and stocking programs are frequently left out of discussions of their value in assessment, or are sidelined as less relevant to decision-making than the more easily measured economic, ecological, or genetic outcomes. This helps explain why the hatchery debate persists, and new conservation stocking programs continuing to take flight despite a sometimes touted consensus in the literature advising otherwise. Now, while some explain this as a series of errors in human attitudes, incentives, and understanding of risk, and proclaim stocking to be stuck in a conceptual or operational rut, we suggest instead that conservation approaches designed solely to adhere to biological or ecological outcomes are missing the inherently human endeavor that is conservation. In other words, conservation stocking for iconic salmon species often includes inexplicit social objectives that these programs may be successfully meeting, thus changing the calculus for local conservationists as to how they view stocking efficacy, measure success, and evaluate risk. In other words, the hatchery conservation paradox is only true if social outcomes and objectives are not accounted for. And to that end, genetics-driven evaluation of hatchery success is poorly suited to account for or measure these social outcomes, or to capture the evolving reconceptualizations of human-salmon relationships in a changing climate that just cannot be measured solely by assemblages of DNA. Moreover, the environment in which this calculus plays out is also changing. Record-breaking heat waves, droughts, and extreme weather events have had devastating impacts on salmon populations, and unprecedented disaster mitigation efforts are being pursued to mitigate mass mortality events. With these competing ontologies of salmon conservation in mind, we see local-level practitioners and managers becoming trapped in a decision-making vice in places where conservation hatcheries sit in these rapidly shifting environmental and social contexts. On one side of that vice, genetics-driven science and policy support the removal and/or reduction of conservation stocking, often with the potential for social conflict where social objectives and outcomes of stocking are threatened. And on the other side of that vice, rapid environmental and accompanying social change that situate practitioners and managers in impending no-analog climate futures, where the only acceptable approaches to stocking-based salmon conservation are highly technical, like gene banks, or often expensive and require significant technical expertise. Or they might require existing fish stocks, an intact yet underutilized ecosystem capacity, and the historical knowledge and technical ability to establish how genetically wild salmon can be known in that system. In our experiences working with local salmon stocking communities and fisheries managers who work with limited data and resources, this vice is squeezing out those most in need of a robust tool belt of conservation options as they cope with the novel ecosystems of the Anthropocene. Rather than further tightening this vice through polarizing debates over hatchery technologies, we ask, is it possible to approach these complex problems in a way that better allows local-level practitioners to work with the environments they have rather than those of the past, while still giving attention to best available science and conservation practices? Now, acknowledging the Anthropocene does require rethinking definitions of desirable ecological conditions, particularly in whether those definitions are achievable or, at the local level, practical. Some authors have questioned previous approaches to maintaining or restoring historic existing assemblages of organisms or habitats, arguing that linear projections or static views of nature or natural systems or natural regimes for fire, water, or biodiversity might have limited utility. Others have explained that many restoration projects are driven by a commitment to historical ecologies and the often good qualities that we assign to them, and they make attempts to reestablish past relationships between people and ecosystems. But if those past relationships, and we are referring here to the recent past, wherein human ecosystem relationships practiced by indigenous peoples for thousands of years have been fundamentally disrupted and altered through colonization, industrialization, and urbanization from European settlers, if those past relationships between people and ecosystems have led to our current state of biodiversity loss, cascading natural disasters, and other environmental crises, should we be striving to recreate or preserve them? Do they serve the social ecological future toward which we are moving? If our previous nature-endorsing approaches have continually separated humans from nature and wildness, how do these views stand up to the inherently nature-skeptical reality we now occupy, where the delineation between humans and nature has become nearly impossible to identify? As the Anthropocene situates system-wide threats as likely to only be mitigated and never removed, these arguments require that conservationists rethink their adherence to past ecological baselines and the relationships with nature that were based upon them. It is with these questions in mind that we offer a multifaceted critique of the current genetics-driven approach to defining wildness in salmon conservation, and consequently, what technologies may be permitted for, particularly local, conservation work. Section 4, Rethinking Wild in the Anthropocene. The literature debating concepts of wildness are multidisciplinary and wide-ranging, spanning fields of restoration ecology to philosophy. In the hatcheries literature, wildness is complicated by the mixing of hatchery and non-hatchery origin fish genetics and their offspring. New assemblages of wild and non-wild genetics are less wild and by extension, less fit. Though from the riverbank or end of a reel they may seem qualitatively and behaviorally wild, they fall neatly into neither category. The offspring of these half-wild, half-not-wild fish are even more complex, as more permutations of wild and non-wild interactions occur, particularly if they are part of salmon populations that have been introgressed by hatchery origin fish for many years. Where does one, or even can one, draw the line between wild and what is somehow less than wild? And on balance, how much does wildness matter in how we construct the future and reckon with the past? In practice, some policies draw this line according to lineage, where wildness is a function of generational distance from hatchery origin, with the goal of maintaining an effective population size. In the United States, for example, offspring of hatchery-born parents can be considered natural origin fish as long as they were born from parents that spawned, quote, in the wild. Meanwhile, in Canada, salmon must be at least two generations removed from hatchery origin before they may be considered wild, irrespective of the origins of the fish prior to those two generations. These definitions of wildness for an anadromous border-crossing fish and the consequences such definitions bring to deciding appropriate and acceptable conservation technologies can seem, in some contexts, poorly aligned with the realities of conservation work. Crucially, this metaphorical teasing of alleles critically misses some aspects of what makes salmon the important fish that they are, and how human-salmon relationships play out. First, definitions of wildness by genetics center Western science to the exclusion of other ways of knowing and relating to salmon, and doubles back to ideas of an Edenic nature and places untrammeled by man. This colonial mindset, in a sense, retools original arguments around techno-arrogance and are potentially an exercise of colonial arrogance or maybe even violence through Western technologies and interventions. Indigenous communities around North America and elsewhere have stewarded relationships with fish since time immemorial. Delineating wild fish only by genetic measures devalues these longstanding relationships and worldviews that hold fish and human in relation to one another, critiques that have been offered by Indigenous voices and scholars, yet are largely ignored in the conservation stocking debate. In this sense, the shackles of wilderness are inappropriate and dehumanizing constructs that can further alienate Indigenous and arguably non-Indigenous societies from salmon relationships that may carry them into an uncertain future. Second, wildness via genetics also presents a paradox of simultaneously techno-defined and human-absent wildness, which makes wildness particularly inaccessible to the category of local salmon conservationists and practitioners with whom we work. If live gene banking programs are the only acceptable conservation stocking solution, and only when populations are so critically endangered or exigent that any human-salmon relationship with them has already been restricted or prohibited, this suggests that wildness in the Anthropocene is, again, an exercise in the extraction of a valuable resource that can only be measured by the right technologies and becomes the property of those institutions who define and control the assemblage of genetic material deemed necessary to achieve robust, effective population sizes. In essence, the argument that conservation hatcheries should be removed on the basis of genetic risks is effectively drawing lines around how fish should be. A set of values to uphold and maintain through current epistemological and Western-derived versions of nature that require increasing technology and scientific policing to define and create. In our experiences, such criteria and values are ineffectual at accounting for the social benefits to communities, particularly in rural areas, in which hatcheries are embedded. And as a result, they cannot accurately account for the public support that hatcheries receive, nor the interest in new hatchery programs, particularly as seen recently in some Indigenous communities. Now, I just want to add a little annotation here that we do speak about the interest in some Indigenous communities. There are many that do not share that interest. These things are not a monolith within Indigenous societies and certainly shouldn't be treated as such. All right, back into the text. Now, similarly, we may attempt to define wildness through genetics. This does not translate across multinational policy regimes where definition of wildness are shaped by interactions between scientific, social, and cultural processes. As a result, wildness varies across borders and over time, where a wild salmon on one side of a border loses that status the moment it crosses an invisible political boundary. While salmon are able to traverse the cultural and social relationships between nation and states, it would seem our definitions of their appropriateness struggle to do the same. With these critiques in mind, we argue that decisions about the role of conservation hatchery and stocking programs in the social ecological systems of the future cannot be based solely on genetics or biological criteria. Instead, we ask, how can we achieve good, socially robust, and adaptive systems around hatcheries and stocking programs for salmon and human-salmon relationships that are oriented toward conservation and the conservation of salmon futures? Part 5, adapting ourselves to salmon futures. The impending specter of climate change-driven loss, paired with narrow definitions of appropriate salmon, are squeezing practitioners and communities and managers, all of whom are interested in salmon conservation. Rather than arguing that hatcheries or other conservation approaches only belong where the worst has occurred, or where wildness doesn't matter, perhaps these flawed conservation technologies can be reimagined as facilitators of epistemologies that can rekindle human-nature-salmon relationships and adapt together for the novel ecosystems of the future and those that are already here. In other words, conservation hatcheries, when operated using best practices in appropriate places and times and with appropriate monitoring and evaluation, can be facilitators of stewardship that may reforge biotic and abiotic nature-skeptical stewardship for these ragged edges of the salmon world. Some authors have argued that conservation is undergoing a paradigm shift towards stewardship conservation, whereby top-down command and control approaches to managing the environment are giving way to an embrace of ethical and reciprocal relationships between humans and ecosystems. We optimistically agree and suggest that acknowledging how humans and nature are inextricably intertwined and codependent could adapt dominant epistemological paradigms toward embracing that humans have long depended on salmon, and that in the Anthropocene, some salmon populations, and certainly human-salmon relationships, may now depend upon human intervention to persist. To do so, it is not enough to only make changes to conservation practices. Adapting ourselves requires deeper transformation in the epistemic culture that constitutes human-salmon relationships and our scientific definitions of how those relationships should take place. Supporting this paradigm shift in the context of salmon conservation hatcheries will require flexible approaches, such as adaptive co-management, as well as adaptive epistemologies in the scientific community that reevaluate what good is against practical, livable, and responsive futures. Adaptive epistemologies build on studies of knowledge and justified belief by challenging how scientists deal with environmental change or socio-technical transitions, such as those presented by conservation hatcheries and stocking in the context of climate change and in the context of these complex human-salmon relationships. A 2020 study by Hirsch and Long of adaptive epistemologies in the Columbia River Basin provides an interesting basis for envisioning an alternative future for conservation hatcheries. They document several adaptation strategies that are enabling a shift toward more flexible and stable knowledge infrastructures, and I'll lay out a few of them here. One, modeling future ecosystem states to design restoration programs. Two, designing physical and social infrastructure for longer time horizons. And three, embracing interdisciplinary and diverse knowledge systems. While hatcheries and their associated stocking programs, particularly when operated carelessly or in ignorance of best practices, can most certainly be harmful to salmon conservation goals, the cultivation of salmon can have value to the human ecologies that surround human-salmon relationships and environments. In our eyes, conserving these relationships, even if occasionally through flawed technologies, is critical to the conservation of salmon themselves. Genomics and other modes of natural science are, without question, critical to creating adaptive conservation plans for salmon futures. However, they must be considered a tool in a broad socio-ecological suite of management approaches and not the penultimate definition of what salmon is good, appropriate, or valuable. It could be that in the future, any salmon, regardless of origin or wildness, is one worth keeping. These epistemological shifts must be accompanied by transformations in the broader colonial structures, objectives, and mindsets that structure fisheries science and management. It is more urgent than ever to re-examine the reliance on Western scientific criteria for evaluating success and reimagine alternative futures that make room for other ways of knowledge and relating to salmon. The concerns of salmon conservation stocking are not alleviated by social considerations, but rather give theoretically expanded room to evaluate hatchery and stocking efforts. We frequently hear calls from fisheries managers for stronger tools to incorporate and balance the social and ecological considerations of the systems they manage. To that end, we are working to develop a framework that will allow for the incorporation of sociocultural considerations into the difficult decision of when, how, and where to stock or maybe not to stock for salmon conservation. We reiterate that it is essential for hatchery programs to establish clear social objectives and corresponding evaluation criteria for a wide set of areas, including clearly stated socio-ecological objectives, robust community engagement, equitable benefit sharing, and the preservation of cultural practices tied to human-salmon relationships. This also includes the need for exit strategies or off-ramps should objectives not be met, as well as careful attention to the process of decision-making throughout. Section 6, Conclusion, Final Thoughts and Warnings. In this perspective, we explore the salmon conservation hatchery and stocking debate through the lens of change, both in the environment and in ourselves. We argue that the means of measuring the success of salmon conservation hatchery and stocking programs should include and go beyond genetic reference points, which may mean rethinking our scientific relationships with baselines to wild salmon ecologies of the past as we hurtle forward into the Anthropocene. We suggest that the present hatchery debate is missing a broader engagement with the social and cultural contexts in which conservation hatcheries operate and the vice-like challenges that salmon communities face in conserving salmon relationships. We argue for the value of adapting not only our conservation technologies, but also our own epistemological assumptions and positions, and suggest ways forward for reimagining hatcheries as conservators of human-salmon relationships. That said, we conclude this article with acknowledgement that our arguments here may be perceived in two ways. One, as ignorant and promoting of shifting ecological baselines, or two, tacit permission for the proliferation of salmon stocking programs in the name of conservation. And we wish to warn against both of these potential conclusions. First, shifting ecological baselines is contingent on human forgetting. That is, new generations of managers forgetting or never seeing the ecological quality or abundance that forms a true baseline against which to assess management efforts broadly. Our argument is not to forget or ignore, but rather to look forward to futures that await us with clear eyes and reasonably question whether our standards, methods, and ways of thinking are appropriate for salmon and ourselves in places that meet the contexts laid out in this paper. Second, we reiterate that we share high-level agreement with the many faceted critiques leveled against salmon stocking programs. Hatcheries produce risks for non-hatchery origin fish and their ecosystems, and these risks are significant in conservation of focused programs. Our arguments in this paper should not be construed as reasons to excuse or ignore those risks. Whenever possible, risks of all varieties should be minimized. Objectives of hatcheries and stocking programs should be stated clearly and time-bound and monitored, and best cultivation practices should be followed. Ultimately, conservation hatcheries are inherently a bandage over deeper problems, and any hatchery or stocking program should come at minimum in tandem with efforts to improve upon those root problems. As stated before, sometimes the best solution will be to close a hatchery program or avoid establishing one altogether. However, we also see a broader and more complex picture of the socio-ecological environment in which conservation hatcheries and stocking programs are embedded. We encourage all participants in this debate to think critically about how, as Thorsted et al. Say in their 2021 paper, quote, policies and decisions that disconnect people from wild salmon or cause them to feel alienated from conservation efforts can be counterproductive to long-term conservation goals, end quote. We strongly agree with this call for innovative solutions that maintain human connections to salmon, though we acknowledge that our team may not agree with those original authors about that mode of connection making. And we suggest that a new paradigm, one that is grounded in those relationships, is needed to advance debates about wildness and the role of conservation hatcheries in human salmon futures. That's all there is for this paper, but I do want to read some acknowledgments here. We want to thank two of our dear colleagues who gave their comments early on in drafts of this article, and to our broader network of colleagues whose work and camaraderie has really inspired some of the ideas that we present here. Thank you. We also want to express our gratitude to and for the fish and waters and the lands on which we work. We also acknowledge and appreciate the very many practitioners, scholars, and conservationists on all sides of the hatchery debate who share a love for salmon. Finally, we want to thank the editors of Fish and Fisheries and the three amazing reviewers who provided very thoughtful and helpful comments. Honestly, this work was so improved by their feedback, and we're really, really grateful for the time they invested in writing those reviews. Thanks again for listening to this podcast. I'm Hannah Harrison at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia. If you would like to find the online version of this paper with all of its accompanying references and other things you might expect with normal scholarship, you can do so by looking in the show notes of this episode where we have pasted the link. Thanks again for listening.